The Bee Sting is one of my favourite novels of the past couple of years. When I picked it up, I found myself laughing aloud before I'd even got to the end of the first page, utterly transfixed by the teenaged voices of Cass Barnes and her toxic friend Elaine, as they try to make sense of life in a small town in the Irish Midlands. I was unsurprised. I was already a big fan of author Paul Murray and his previous three novels, and I'd come to expect the sharp dialogue, the fully realised human beings on the page, generous humour, and brutal insights. What I was maybe underprepared for was that some 650 pages later, I would be utterly hollowed out by the tragedy of the whole thing. Sad and anxious, not just for the characters and their fates, but for life and humanity in general. How is it that such a deeply pessimistic book can be funny, and at times, even uplifting?
I find sort of pessimism quite attractive, and whenever I read like a super pessimistic book or see a super pessimistic movie, it sort of resonates with me. But it's not something that I really believe in. I'm not someone who believes that people are bad and, you know, the world is fucked. Like, that's not the way I see things.
I'm Michael Williams, and this is Read This, a show about the books we love and the stories behind them. Paul Murray's last two novels, the brilliant Skippy Dies, which was set in a boys' school, and the surreal The Mark and the Void, which was set in the world of banking, were both modern masterpieces of institutional failure. And for his 2023 Booker shortlisted novel, The Bee Sting, the failing institution he turns his comedic eye to is the family. In alternating chapters, from the perspective of four different members, he follows the Barnes family. And it's maybe more than anything else the story of what happens when people who love each other can't talk to one another, can't share the truth or what they need or what they're going through. He writes kids and teenagers brilliantly well, and the relationship between parents and their children, the everyday failures of empathy and imagination, the cross-generational incomprehension and disappointment, run through every page of this book. So to kick things off, I asked Paul about his own parents and about how they might have influenced his work.
My dad passed away a couple of months ago. He was a university professor here in Dublin, so the house was always full of books, and that was the big sort of weekly family trip. We'd go to the local town and go to the library and get more books. My dad really was uneasy about me writing. Like he was happy enough when I was just doing it in school as homework, but then when I decided I wanted to do it like full time, he rarely said anything. But there was a famous occasion when I did a master's in creative writing in Norwich in the UK when I was about 25. And it was great. Like, it was a real sort of like life-changing experience. But I remember coming back from that and moving back in with my parents, and I was out of money, you know, and he was driving me to the train station one day, and he said, like, you've given it your best shot. It's time to just set it aside and get a real job. So like the next day it might've been that very nice. In fact, it was really weird sort of serendipity, but I got an email from my tutor in Norwich, Ali Smith. She's a famous novelist, and she told her editor in Penguin about me, and he emailed me saying I'd love to see your work, and I sent him the work, and he bought the book. So that was a real moment. But my dad was always like, he was still sending me like job advertisements, you know, from the newspaper saying, you know, things that I would like always be like, just like I would never be even qualified for, but he'd just be saying, you know, give it a shot, you know, give it a go. So he was like a very gentle, kind of a courteous figure. Like I'd always meet students, ex-students of his, who would talk about like how generous he'd been with them, like a very sort of like unshowy kind of a man. My mum was like sort of my mum's still alive, and she's a real firebrand, and she came from this sort of quite dark part of Ireland, and she sort of retains that sense of, you know, the world as being this place of unfathomable darkness, you know, so any kind of situation you would put her in, she would find the seam of darkness in there. So, I mean, like, that's definitely part of me as a person, and also part of the writing too.
I read an old interview with you where you talked about that thing when you become a parent and you realize the way in which everyone's just faking it, that you have to pretend authority because it's not an option to say, I don't know, I'm making this up as I go along. And I think each stage of life, whether it's parenting, whether it's being an adult, whether it's old age and mortality, there is an extent to which you're expected to just do it.
Well, I remember coming home when my son was born, coming home with the baby. The first night he stayed in hospital, and the second day he had to prove you had a car seat. So you could take him out of the hospital if you had a car seat, so you could put him in the car. And that was the extent of proof that you needed, that you were sort of an acceptable parent. And I remember taking the car seat into the house and putting it on the kitchen table and thinking, what now? What do you do? Because we had no preparation. No one tells you anything about how to raise a child. And the degree of improvisation was very, very surprising, you know? And it hadn't even struck me that we didn't know what to do. We bought a lot of products, and I think that's a really interesting sort of 21st century thing, because I find myself repeating it again and again. In any sort of given situation, the first thing is go on Amazon and see I'll buy these 10 things, and that's how you do it, you know? And with my dad's death, that was a rare instance where there's nothing available to you, you know? It's just, you're just sort of in it and you just have to get through it. But with regard to parenting, it was really, I guess it was when the kid gets older then, and you have to sort of be the authority figure. And especially if you imagine yourself as an artist whose job it is to stand at the margins, kind of sneer, the cigarette dripping from your lip, and just sort of be throwing glasses and stuff, you have to kind of reconfigure yourself as this person who's wagging their finger all the time and saying, now, mind out, excuse me, now be careful of this and be careful of that. The amount of times in my daily life that I would be saying, no, stop that, no, be careful, and just hearing yourself just becoming this voice of just restriction and limitation and just, you know, repression. And so, yeah, with my son, when he complains about school and I have to go well, there's a reason, because if you don't go to school, you don't learn things and you can't get a job and you won't be able to get a mortgage and you won't find a wife, whatever it might be. And it's painting this picture of the most sort of mainstream version of life that you can imagine. And the last book I wrote, not the last book, but the book before, so Skippy Dies, was it was written before my son was born, but I was in my mid-30s and I already had a sense of this generational pretense or generational disguise, because people I'd gone to school with, who again were people you would never trust to do anything, not even sort of put up a shelf or dog sit, whatever it might be, were now sort of in positions where they were being paid a lot of money to manage things or to treat people who were very sick, or they were put in positions of power and authority and trust. And that was quite a shock, because when you met them, they still seemed as unhinged as ever. And you start to realize that there's no point in your life where you sort of actually become, you don't change into that kind of person. It's more that you sort of learn to behave in a certain way in certain situations. But the person you were doesn't fade out. It's just that you just learn not to say the things that you want to say. The things you would say when you're 15, you go and even now when I'm doing, for instance, an interview, the 15-year-old part of me will go we'll have something to say. I've got a bit of delay now where my brain will go don't say that, That's not appropriate.
I mean, one of the things, to stick with Skippy Dies for a second, one of the most beautiful things in that book is how deeply lived in and authentic the young voices are in it. Is that inner 15-year-old voice omnipresent?
There's a line in, I think in Peter Pan, talking about growing older, and he says it's the strangest thing to happen to a little boy, And it's just this, at some level, we all feel this bewilderment at growing older and the fact that certain ways of being are no longer available to us, I don't want to be a teenager by any stretch, but I wouldn't mind being 30 again. That'd be great. So I guess, in one regard, I'm lucky enough to have a good ear, certainly for teenage voices. But also the vulnerabilities are still there and the desires are still there. And it's more just a sense of realism, basically, that creeps in, that you realize that the romantic sort of illusions that I had when I was a teenager. And I guess that's what I associate most with being a teenager, is that just the all these just very romantic ideas of what love is like and what life is like and how sort of life unfolds. Like those are things that are gone and I can't get back to. And I don't want to get back to. But at the same time, I wouldn't want any teenager to not to have those, you know, like that, just that sense that, you know, that life can be this beautiful opera.
I think one of the things about aging, you use the word bewilderment, which I think is absolutely right. But the other thing that Peter Pan quote conjures up for me is the idea of the inevitability of a sense of fraudulence when you get older, because you're projecting a capable adult in the world on the one hand, but inside you're still a mass of anxieties and doubts and pretenses and whatever. And it seems to me that in that configuration of getting older, a sense of fraudulence is an inevitable part of it.
I think you realize that there are roles to play. With like parenting in particular, it's like a kind of acting, you know? I mean, even a simpler thing is telling someone it's going to be all right. Like it's, you know, everything's going to be all right. Like a large part of being an adult is just saying it's under control and it's going to be all right. And people are surprisingly trusting when they hear those words. But I've never felt it's going to be all right. Like, I mean, I've never felt like things are going to work out. But it's very important. Yeah, so much of being an adult is just, it's like learning to fit in with the sort of the setup that you're given. So if you're young, you can define yourself in terms of opposition and saying, well, I'm like a rebel and I'm not going to take part in this like society. And then you realize like as you get older that like there's no real outside to it, you know, and you have to find some way of making sense of yourself in it. It's like a negotiation. Like what's an acceptable compromise between your sort of conception of yourself and the way that society allows you to be.
Your deep tenderness for all your characters, I think, is one of the things that makes you one of my favourite writers. And across all your books, is even the monstrous characters or the ones that are expressly without quality, you have this kind of tenderness towards them. And I'm interested in whether that's an essential thing for you when you're writing.
I think that's... So George Saunders, when I'm teaching a class on character, I always pull up this piece that George Saunders wrote for The Guardian, where he talks about exactly that. He talks about how, as one goes about one's normal day, you're prey to the same kind of snap decisions and dismissals and shortchangings of the people that you meet as anyone else. Like, writers are definitely not saints. But when you're writing sort of an extended piece, particularly like a novel, you're spending so much time with the characters that, you know, you can't help but sort of dig deeper into the things that are motivating them and the reasons they're acting as they are. So, like, his example is, like, you know, sort of a cartoonish version of it. Bob was an asshole. Bob was an asshole because he snapped at the barista. But then your job as the writer is to kind of, like, follow that thread and go, like, why did Bob snap at the barista? Bob snapped at the barista because he was late for work. He was late for work because it was his wife's anniversary and his wife, you know, or whatever it might be. And the more you think about Bob, the more you realize that like his behavior is coming from like a deep well of experience and some of it is very bitter and difficult. And that's just what it is to be a human being. So when you're writing, like that's essentially what you're doing. You're sort of dwelling with these characters over a long period of time. And you realize that by dwelling with them, it's like you're sharing space with them or sharing your time with them.
When we come back, we dig into the bee sting itself, and I beg Paul for reassurance that everything's going to be okay. We'll be right back. It's actually really hard talking to Paul Murray about the bee sting, because like anyone who's read it, I'm full of questions, not least about its ending, which is one for the ages. But as a book of such delights and surprises across its epic 650 pages, I'm also loath to spoil it for anyone who's yet to crack the spine. Against a backdrop of existential crises, financial, climate, social, the Barnes family are falling to pieces. The father, Dickie, is trying desperately to keep his struggling car dealership afloat, acutely aware of the disappointed judgment of his father, Morris. Dickie's wife, Imelda, is lost in her own memories of compromises past, trying to remember who she is and find a way back into her own life. Their daughter Cass is in her last year at high school and disillusioned with everything, and their son PJ is 12, terrified by the ways his family is fracturing before his eyes. Cross-generational pressures play out, familial, mythic, sexual, social, and all the while the characters hurtle towards a tragic fate. There should really be too much going on here, but the book's great success lies in the humanity of its characters. Murray moves between different perspectives, and the voices are each distinct and each indelible.
Empathy is really the name of the game, as far as I can see. Certainly for me. So even if I've got like sort of like a villainous character, and there aren't many villains in the things I write, but there are some characters that I am sort of ill-disposed towards. So like in The Bee Sting, I think Morris is a pretty kind of a bad guy. Daddy's a bad guy. But nevertheless, it's not interesting to me, or it feels like sort of dishonest to me to just have them there as like as villains sort of twirling their mustaches, because they too have a past. They've come from somewhere. And when I think about like where they've come from, so Morris, for instance, Dickie's dad, he's come from an impoverished background. He's made something of himself. He's very proud of that, and to the point that he sort of sees himself on top of a, you know, a pedestal. But at the same time, like, he can't be just sort of reduced to a caricature. And you can tell when you're writing, like, if a character is one-dimensional, it's not satisfying to write, and it feels kind of cheap. It's very hard to tell when you're writing if anything is working or not. If the characters feel like sort of they've got some depth, then that's where the path is coming from. Like, that's where the next line or the next chapter is coming from. Whereas if they're kind of like cardboard villains, then it tends to not generate ideas in the same way.
It's interesting, those characters you identify as the kind of potentially more villainous ones in your work are in some ways an embodiment of a particular kind of modernity and a particular kind of late capitalist, you know, an expression of social wrongs rather than individual failures. That the corruption in both those cases comes from the ways in which society is letting individuals down. You know, in The Mark and the Void, in Skippy Dies, and certainly in The Bee Sting, part of the story you're telling is one of a society that is failing as much as anything else.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I'm interested in those points where, just as we were talking earlier about like roles you have to inhabit, you can achieve great power by adhering to those roles. At the same time, your sense of yourself as a human being would really rest on the moments where you have to step away from those roles, you know, like be it like as a parent, but maybe more so like in terms of work, where you kind of think, if I let this happen, then very bad things will happen. There'll be very bad consequences for people in positions of vulnerability. So Dickie's got this sense that like the world is bad and people are hostile, and the only thing you can do is like protect yourself from them, you know, and like hide yourself away, because otherwise they're going to destroy you. And like, that's something I would have felt like when I was, you know, like when I was a kid, like just that sort of vulnerability. And, you know, like, because I've had like a lucky life, like I've, you know, you learn to trust people, and that people are like largely good, and you can live in the world and be yourself to a certain degree, and that will all be fine. But Dickie's never learned to do that. He's always just had this illusion that the only way to be is other than yourself. Try and fit in as best you can. And if you don't do that, you know, you're doomed. So there's no way out for him, because like he can't, the moment comes and it's said to him explicitly, you have to trust your family and just tell them, you have to tell them what's happened, and just believe that their love for you is going to overpower whatever feelings of shock or horror that they might experience at the things that you've done. And on one level, like, he knows it. He knows it's true. He knows his family loves him and will forgive him anything, and they'll come back, you know, in whatever way that would work, they'll come back to him. But he can't make himself do it. He can't trust him. Like, you know, so, and that's what it's like to live without. It's a sort of nightmarish version, I guess, of what it's like to conceive of yourself as an individual. You know, the ultimate rendition of this, the capitalistic individual, you're totally on your own. And that's hell. Like, it's hell to be on your own.
But the great tragedy of the bee sting, it seems to me, is that for the Barneses, for each of them, the things they desire, the things they need, by and large aren't incompatible, but they're just not seen to one another. They're not able to say, here's the thing that is keeping me awake at night, here's the thing I want for myself. For the Barneses, the failure, first and foremost, it seems to me, is one of being able to talk to one another.
I think children can pick up on feelings, and the tragedy of the Barnes family is that, so Dickie, the father, is, he's playing a role, but the kids, on some level, like an unconscious level, can tell that he's not fully there. And because he's not fully there, and he's stopped being able to be honest with them, just as they're sort of, they're hitting their teens, he's a good dad when they're little kids. But as they get older, he becomes less and less able to speak to them. And because obviously of the circumstances in the book where he's found himself painted into a corner, basically, from, it all comes from the top down, this sense of like, of the need to self-conceal hits the kids too. So this atmosphere of like mutual distrust becomes kind of the prevalent one. And I think it's coming from Dickie because like he's sort of setting the tone. Like the marriage, like the two parents, like their marriage is obviously quite strange, and there's like major secrets there. And to a certain degree, they've always been pretending. But there's also like there's little moments in the book where you can see that there's a capacity to love each other. There's a capacity to communicate with each other, but they keep on turning away from us because they ultimately they don't trust each other. And because they don't trust each other, then the situations, the individual sort of problems that they have or traps that they've found themselves wandering into become that much harder to get out of.
I think it's what makes PJ such a moving character throughout the book is the ways in which he's the one who's invested in the family unit still. He's the one who still hopes that it'll all be okay, hopes that loving each other will be enough to kind of bring them back together when they're fragmented. And it's, I mean, some of the biggest moments of comedy in the book come from his sections, I think. But also just that sense of grief, that sense of something that's lost, is maybe most acute there.
Yeah, I mean, so the characters, like, they're really all, certainly when you meet them at first, they all seem sort of so lost in themselves and so disillusioned with the family and so determined to just sort of escape. And imagine that the only way that they can become themselves or save themselves is to get away from this family, get away from this town, and start again on their own as individuals. Except for PJ, partly because he's 12, so he's he can't leave the family really. But he's a believer. Like he's kind of an optimist. He's someone who's very, he's got all these facts about nature, and he just is interested in the world, and he sort of loves the world in this kind of quite naive way. But he wants the family to, and he believes the family can come back together if they just sort of talk to each other. And he's not wrong, you know? But because he's 12, the mode of bringing them together is like he does this quite extreme thing and he tries to run away. And I guess like PJ is, he's the most vulnerable, you know? And he's the one who sort of, he's at the sharp end of everything that's happening. Even though no one really sees him, like in the family, he's just sort of this kind of like a bit of a pest because he just sort of appears and says the wrong thing or starts, you know, telling them facts about nature. And so they're always kind of like dismissing him and shushing him. But at the same time, he's the one who's sort of the most exposed to the consequences of being alone, of being abandoned, you know, of being sort of an individual in the world because he doesn't really know how things work. And there are people out there who want to take advantage of that.
Ultimately, the bee sting for all its moments of great comedy and joy and beauty, still remains for me a deeply pessimistic book. Like, remains for me a book that seems to be about the ways in which we're doomed as a people, as a society. Am I reading it wrong? Make me feel better, Paul.
It's very, very difficult when you take the wide view to see a huge amount of hope, frankly. At the same time, when you don't take the wide view, when you are just like a person walking around in the world and you're talking to people and among people, like I say, people don't, no one wants the world to go up in flames. Like, I feel like we're all to a certain degree in Dickie's position, whereby, and I think that's maybe the reason why people sort of have kind of connected with this book. We're all in this position where we've sort of been taught to believe that life is a certain way, which is that we're all alone. And, you know, when push comes to shove, you have to look out for number one because other people are just going to drag you down. But that's not a sort of viable way of being. So I live in Dublin in Ireland, and it's a place where, and it's a sense I got from my brief time in Australia too, like that it's a place where there's a lot of community. You know, there's a sense that networks, for want of a better word, are important to people, and people do see the value of having friends and having family and having people around them who they can speak to. And I think if you're aware of that, then you're aware that it's worth preserving, and you're aware that it is valuable and that it offers things that stuff consumerism like can't really replace. But just generally, like in terms of pessimism, like when I was finishing that book, I mean, I felt like it ends with like that's a dark statement. Like, there's no denying that. But at the same time, I think the dark statement, I think the ending works, because you can see as a reader that like there's an alternative there, like that this is a family. They aren't all ourselves. Like, as individual people, like, they're nice. If you met them in the pub, you'd talk to them, and you think, like, that was a pleasant conversation. But equally, like, they have the capacity to relate to each other and love each other and be honest with each other. In another life, on a better day even, you know, they would be able to dig themselves out of the situation.
Just before I let you go, I did want to ask, after that shaky start with your dad sending you job ads for other jobs and other things you could do, as you became published in each of the books, did he read you, and did that change his belief in the value of being a writer for you?
Like you would think. He might have pivoted to things that were more sort of writing adjacent. So he'd say, like, there's a librarian position in Sligo County Library, so he might be able to do that. But with the bee sting, I told them not to read us. I told my parents, don't read it because it's too traumatic. But they did read us. And that was the first time he really changed his mind. Like, it's been such a blessed book. Like, it's sort of had such an amazing run that even a parent who's constantly worried that their child is going to end up on the streets, even he could see that it had gone well. And he was really proud of us. And you know, someone said to me, like, when he was sick, aren't you lucky that he was around to see us, like, that he's around to see us? And I hadn't thought of that. But I was lucky. I am lucky that he was around to see it, because he got such, even when he was dying, I remember, like, when he was in hospital, going to see him, and he couldn't speak anymore. I told him I was going to London. I'd been shortlisted for not one but two prizes. And I was saying this to him, and he looked just so sick, and he was so diminished. It was so sad. But I said, oh, yeah, I won't see you till next week, because I've got to go to London and I've got these two prizes. And he just had this huge smile. He was just so happy. And that was a moment that I'll always remember, you know. And I think if you're a parent, all you want is for your kids to be okay and to feel like that, you know, when you go, your kids are going to be okay and have like happy lives. So I think certainly for a moment, he was able to kind of believe that was, you know, we're going to be all right. So I was really grateful for that.
All four of Paul Murray's wonderful novels are available at all good bookstores. I'd give a particular plug for The Hilarious Madness of Skippy Dies. And if you need to join a group therapy session to discuss the end of the bee sting, email us at readthis@schwartzmedia.com.au. Before we go, I wanted to let you know what I've been reading this week. And it made me laugh a lot when I heard that Shock Doctrine author Naomi Klein was writing a book about being serially mistaken for beauty myth author Naomi Wolf. Despite being a big fan of Klein's, I have more than once had to do a double take to remember which Naomi is which. Well, it's important to say that Klein's latest book, Doppelganger, which has just won the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, is much more than just a throwaway joke. It's an amazing book. It's about identity and contemporary life, about the divide between being a public intellectual and a conspiracy theory-toting grifter. It's a fascinating read. You can find it and all the others we mentioned at your favourite independent bookstore. That's it for this week's show. If you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and rate and review. It helps a lot. Next week on Read This, I speak with a literary legend, the Sri Lankan-born Canadian writer and poet Michael Ondaatje. He's been publishing work for more than 50 years. Read This is produced and edited by Clara Ames, mixing and original compositions by Zoltan Fetcher. Thanks for listening. See you next week.